This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. The U.S. House of Representatives will take the historic step of drafting articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has the story.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the House will draft articles of impeachment.
His wrongdoing strikes at the very heart of our Constitution.
Saying he left Democrats no choice but to move ahead.
He's the one who's dividing the country on this.
The president said little about impeachment before reporters hours later.
It's a hoax. It's a big fat hoax.
He'd earlier tweeted Democrats should get on with it so he can get a fair trial in the GOP-led Senate. The House is expecting a full vote by Christmas in just the fourth case of Congress trying to remove a chief executive. Sagar Magani at the White House.
A senior U.S. official said Iranian forces may have killed more than 1,000 people in response to protests that were sparked by the government's sudden and dramatic increase in fuel prices.
We cannot be certain because the regime blocks information. Among those murdered are at least a dozen children, including 13 and 14-year-olds.
Brian Hook acknowledged that the death toll figures were difficult to confirm, but they are certain many hundreds were killed and thousands wounded. Protests erupted last month after the government hiked fuel prices by as much as 300%. The U.S., which views Iran as its top adversary, has urged people in Iran to send footage of the protests if they could sidestep internet restrictions in the country. France public transport networks ground to a near halt on Thursday as unions dug in for a nationwide strike aimed at forcing President Emmanuel Macron to abandon plans to overhaul the country's Byzantine pension system. We'll have more on that story coming up in just a moment. But meantime, as always, for more news, you can join us at voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Back in France, at the strike, President Emmanuel Macron abandoning plans to overhaul the country's Byzantine pension system. And we get more on that story right now from Francesca Lenar.
Thousands of railway workers, teachers and emergency room medics walked out of work and onto the streets in protest. According to BFM News Channel, police fired tear gas at demonstrators in Nantes. In Lyon, banners reading Macron get lost and don't touch our pensions were on display. And in Paris, the transport network ground to a near halt and the Eiffel Tower was closed to visitors. Transport unions have set no end date for the strike, which is one of the biggest public sector actions in decades.
That was Francesca Lenar reporting. U.S. and British law enforcement officials announced charges against two Russian cyber criminals, accusing them of engaging in a decade-long crime spree that resulted in tens of millions of dollars in losses to victims around the world. Brian Benskowski is the Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department's Criminal Division.
Yakubets is a true 21st century criminal who, with the stroke of a key and the click of a mouse, committed cybercrimes across the globe. He's earned his place on the FBI's list of the world's most wanted cyber criminals.
Both men remain at large. The U.S. State Department announced a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the arrests and convictions. A company that claims to have the first drug to slow mental decline from Alzheimer's disease made its case to scientists on Thursday at the Alzheimer's Conference in San Diego, California. AP correspondent Shelley Adler has that story.
The drug is called Ducanumab, and its goal is to help the body clear harmful plaques or protein clumps from the brain. Its developers stopped studies earlier this year because it didn't seem to be working, then did a stunning about-face in October and said new results suggest it was effective at a higher dose. Mary Carrillo is with the Alzheimer's Association and had no role in the study.
These are really uncharted waters for the Alzheimer's community. And what we can say about a 23% reduction in cognitive decline is that it is the largest reduction that we have seen to date in a clinical study.
The company leading the development of the drug, Biogen, says it will seek FDA approval early next year. I'm Shelley Adler.
South Sudan's government has opened a special tribunal to try National Security Service operatives accused of committing crimes. Authorities say the tribunal is an attempt to end the impunity and restore the image of service damaged by numerous reports of human rights abuses. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Friday, December 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United Nations Food Program says it needs $200 million to ease food insecurity in Zimbabwe.
We are running against time because we need to have these commodities in country by January for us to implement this program at scale.
Eddie Rowett is the director of the World Food Program. A Rwandan opposition leader says she has been denied permission to receive an award outside the country. Deaf people in Cameroon demand to be heard. A Kenyan World Heritage town is worried that development will dilute the culture. And diaspora Liberians will convene a two-day all-Liberian conference today in Washington.
Issues that will be discussed include economic development for the country and the related issues that affect economic development, which include dual citizenship for natural-born Liberians abroad and even the issue of war crimes.
John Lloyd is the chair of the All Liberian Diaspora Conference, and the popularity of black African churches is growing in London. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations World Food Program says it is struggling to raise more than $200 million to ease food insecurity in Zimbabwe. Economic collapse and recurring droughts in the country, once the breadbasket of Southern Africa, have left 5.5 million people without enough food to eat. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Maria Gunzi is using a hoe tilling her land as Zimbabwe's rainy season begins. But the 66-year-old widow is worried that she will not have enough food to last until the next harvest. Hunger and poverty are real here. I do not have fertilizer for the land I am preparing, she says. All my crops were burned by the sun last season, and there's no food aid coming. I wish the government would chip in with assistance, especially for us, the old. Gunzi is among the 5.5 million people in Zimbabwe who the World Food Program says are food insecure until at least next April because of the collapsed economy and the recurring droughts. Eddie Rowe, the director of World Food Program in Zimbabwe.
For us, we look at the severity of the situation coupled with the fact that the forecast for this 2019-2020 agricultural season is also not good. It is almost similar to last year's forecast. We reckon that we would be in for a long run.
WFP says Zambia, from where the UN agents sometimes imports food to aid Zimbabwe, is also affected by drought and has imposed a ban on corn exports. Also, the agent says it needs to raise more money to help Zimbabwe.
We are running against time because we need to have these commodities in country by January for us to implement this program at scale, reaching 4.1 million people from January up to April, and then 1.5 May and June, it would cost us a total of $293 million. We've only received 30% of that, meaning that we have a funding gap of $211 million.
Any aid would be a relief to Maria Gunzim, who says climate change has affected him, as she used to be able to fend for herself. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
Rwandan dissident Vetowa Ingabire says President Paul Kagame's government denied her an exit permit to travel to Spain to receive the Spanish Human Rights Award for her fight for justice. However, some people in the country still accuse Ingabire of involvement in disseminating genocide ideology. Eugene Uwimana has more from Kigali.
Fitwania or the dissident Victoire Ngabire says she wrote to the Minister of Justice asking permission to fly to Spain for the award, but did not get any response from the Attorney General. She says her trip was slated to take place from December 4 to the 8th. She says, it is over. I'm not still waiting because the award will be given today. There is a way of denying something silently. They have refused. That is what it means. The order that pardoned Victoire Ngabire in 2018 states that she cannot leave the country without the permission of the Minister of Justice. Ngabire told VOA she's going to follow legal procedures to claim her rights. She says, I want to enjoy the right of free movement as provided for in the Ugandan Constitution. It guarantees that. And I don't see the reason why they have taken that right from me without even informing me. Although Ngabire is out of prison, some anti-genocide activists still link her to terror attacks and genocide ideology. Early last month, Rwandan President Paul Kagame warned the people who he said cover themselves with what they call political and human rights activities intended to destabilize the country.
For people who hide behind this nonsense, and they are even backed and praised by people outside, from outside, people who have been involved with the tragedy of genocide and have continued to play that politics and ideology, and they have gone to prison, then they have come out of prison, and for it we have forgiven them, and then they start playing those games again. We will put you where you belong. And those ones who make noises about it, we will see what they will do.
In September 2018, Kagame commuted Victoire Ngabire's prison sentence. She had been sentenced to 15 years for crimes that included minimizing the genocide perpetrated against the Tutsi. She has been active in Rwandan politics since her release. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Deaf people in Cameroon have been protesting what they call a lack of effort by government workers to communicate with them in sign language. Deaf people face major challenges in schools, at police stations, and other public institutions. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
About 30 deaf people marched from the central post office in Cameroon's capital Yaoundé to the prime minister's office, situated less than a kilometer away. Spokesperson Théophile Bongwen, speaking through an interpreter, says they are disgruntled because the government and their communities treat them as outcasts. He says they were particularly angered when a deaf suspect was recently locked up for several hours in a police cell just because the policeman did not understand sign language. He says many of them struggle to access government services because not many workers understand their language.
Au niveau de la justice, il est important que soit on recrute un traducteur.
He says the government should either teach lawyers and judges sign language or recruit people who master sign language because justice cannot be rendered without efficient communication. He says a week ago, a deaf person on transit at the Yaoundé Nsimalen International Airport missed his flight just because no one was able to inform him of the takeoff time. He says most deaf children have remained illiterate because there are no sign language teachers in the majority of the schools in Cameroon, and at times, deaf kids are refused admission. 29-year-old Paul Gaza, also speaking through an interpreter, says they want the government to make communication between civil servants and the deaf community more fluid. He says he is asking the government to recruit sign language interpreters in all public services and schools as a sign it is respecting the rights of those who, to no fault of theirs, are deaf and dumb. Cameroon's Social Affairs Minister, Pauline Irène Guéni, says the government hears the deaf community's complaints and is taking measures to improve their living conditions. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, December 6th. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. Activists say Kenya's remote island of Lamu, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, is under threat. Authorities are constructing major projects on the mainland, including a port and an oil pipeline. They also hope to build the region's first coal-fired plant. While the infrastructure is likely to boost the local economy, some Lamu residents worry that the development and a flood of outsiders will affect the local culture and the architecture, which some say is already falling apart. Rue Elmador reports from Lamu.
We're in the narrow streets of Lamu in Kenya, where cars don't fit and donkeys are the main mode of transport. The remoteness of the island has helped maintain its 650-year-old Swahili culture and traditions. But locals worry construction of a new port, oil pipeline and transport links on the mainland will bring more outsiders to settle in Lamu and change the unique culture. Abu Bakr Badawi is with the century-old Riada Mosque.
We are trying our best to prevent that kind of intervention or sort of the kind of new development so that we can preserve the Lamu.
Authorities say the 26 billion group of projects will improve economic links between Kenya, South Sudan and Ethiopia and create thousands of jobs. But a Kenyan court in June halted construction of a coal-fired power plant that was to help fuel the projects, encouraging opponents. Raya Famau Ahmed is an activist opposed to the coal plant.
We as Lamu people are afraid because when people come from other areas, they come with many things. Their own language, their own culture, I mean their own way of living. And this might alter the cultural way that people have been living.
Activists worry the projects could also affect Lamu town's unique antique character. More than a third of Lamu's historic buildings are already falling apart, says Athman Hussein of the National Museums of Kenya.
Some of the owners do not want any kind of intervention. They think perhaps by putting money into their building, perhaps you are actually owning it. You are taking over that particular building. So it's a very complex kind of thing.
Lamu authorities vow they will protect the island's world heritage from the development projects. Fahima Arafat is with the Lamu County government.
We have also put measures to ensure that the LAPSET activities will remain on the mainland of Lamu, that is Hindi area, Mokowe and the likes. And that's the Lamu Archipelago, that is Lamu Island, starting from Shela all the way to Kipungani, remains with its status of heritage.
Lamu authorities say they are raising funds to help renovate historic buildings and develop the economy with tourism as a major pillar. At the risk of commercializing their culture, some argue that bringing in more tourists may actually help keep Lamu's unique traditions alive. Ruth Almendorp for VOA News, Lamu, Kenya.
Liberian diaspora have gathered in Washington, D.C. for a two-day All-Liberian Diaspora Conference to address issues ranging from economic development to dual citizenship, immigration protection for Liberians abroad, war crimes, and women empowerment. John Lloyd, the chair of the All-Liberian Diaspora Conference, says the conference will also seek to foster collaboration among Liberian organizations as part of an overall effort to forge a united approach to help rebuild Liberia.
These issues that will be discussed include economic development for the country and the related issues that affect economic development, which include dual citizenship for Liberians, natural-born Liberians abroad, and even the issue of war crimes. And immigration protection for Liberians will be the first item on the agenda.
As you mentioned, John, when you listen to Liberia in these days, you hear people talk about the establishment of a war crimes court, dual citizenship. How united are Liberians on these two subjects?
Majority of Liberians
abroad, I would say, favor war crimes. Majority of Liberians abroad favor dual citizenship for natural-born Liberians. And they believe that these issues tie into the economic development of Liberia.
The immigration status of many Liberians, particularly those who came to the United States during the Civil War and the Ebola era, their status is in some kind of jeopardy. Will the conference be addressing this issue?
Yes, DED will be expiring by March, a deferred enforced departure executive order that is usually passed by the U.S. presidents every year, will be expiring again on an annual basis. And as it is every year, it puts Liberians who do not have status, it put them in limbo, it put them in a state of uncertainty. But the Liberian community throughout the United States, the leaders of the different Liberian organizations from the different cities and states will be meeting with legal experts and other concerned Liberians to forge a strategy to lobby the U.S. Congress and the U.S. government for an extension while they seek to lobby the U.S. Congress for a lasting solution.
The Group Council of Patriots are planning a protest in Liberia on December 30th to call on President George Weah to step down. Do you think the conference is likely to endorse or even address the protests on December 30th?
The conference will neither endorse nor address the issue of the COP protest on December 30th. We have many concerns here in the diaspora that we seek to address. And it's not that we ignore the situation at home. We see our brothers and sisters at home as citizens that have the right to express themselves through their constitutional provisions of freedom of expression. But at the same time, we abroad have mounting issues in the diaspora, including the immigration protection of our people here and other issues that we believe that are in best interest of improving our country using our resources here that we seek to look forward to.
John, thank you very much again for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, James.
John Loy is the chair of the two-day All-Liberian Diaspora Conference, which is taking place today, Friday, and tomorrow, Saturday, in Washington, D.C. The largest concentration of black African churches outside of Africa can be found in South London. Each week, about 200,000 people attend one of the mostly Pentecostal churches in the city. Martha van der Wolf has more from London.
There's prayer, but also lots of singing and dancing at the majority black African churches in South London. The House of Praise is one of those churches where hundreds of people gather each Sunday. Precious Ogbomna is of Nigerian heritage and has been attending for more than 2 years. She likes that there's a connection to the African continent.
It gives you a slice of home. So your parents raise you up in a certain culture, and sometimes you can feel a bit alienated outside or somewhere else, and it just feels like home, really.
Many English churches seem to have a declining congregation, but the African churches in South London are growing in popularity due to the large diaspora community residing in this part of London. Public theology lecturer David Murr explains what makes the diaspora churches stand out.
First and foremost, the diversity of these churches. I mean, some churches have got 20 people, some have got maybe 6, but of course there are other churches with 600 plus. So the kind of diversity of those churches is one thing. The second thing is that most of these churches are actually keen to get involved in social action, and they tend to do that in terms of things like education and welfare. But I think what I found very interesting in the churches is the way in which they take mission seriously. A lot of these folks feel that God has actually sent them here to evangelize the local population.
The churches are quite active in the community. Besides Bible study, the House of Praise provides language classes. They also organize other activities such as soup kitchens to feed the homeless. At the House of Praise, like many other churches, more than 80% of the worshippers have African heritage. Assistant Pastor Benga Samuel sees a role for the church to better integrate the diaspora and indigenous community.
We're kind of the seed that was sown by those who brought the gospel earlier on, and we're kind of the fruits of those seeds. We're bringing that back and trying to bring Christ back into the center of everything that is done.
Many of the majority black churches do not own traditional church buildings. The House of Praise bought a former bingo hall to host its congregation. Others use schools or community centers. Perhaps the lack of space in London might in the future be the one thing that will integrate local and diaspora churches. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, London.
For Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with the latest news from the CAF Champions League. After a thrilling opening match day one for the lucrative mini-league stage, the 2019-2020 CAF Champions League action continues this weekend with 8 games taking place across the continent as match day 2 is played on Friday 6th of December through Saturday the 7th of December 2019. Highlight will be in Group C as two former champions lock horns in what has been a classic CAF encounter in recent years. Morocco's Wydad will entertain South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns for the 5th time in the last 3 Champions League edition, including 2 encounters last season. In Group D, DR Congo's AS Vita will entertain Morocco's Raja in the repeat of the 2018 CAF Confederations Cup final, when Raja emerged victorious 4-3 on aggregate and then went on to claim the title. Other fixtures include Esperance of Tunisia welcoming JS Kabylie of Algeria, while Luanda Petro de Luanda of Angola will welcome US Alges, while Bulawayo Platinum of Zimbabwe will be hosting Etoile du Sahel. In Egypt, Cairo Zamalek will be hosting Primeiro de Agosto of Angola, while Ndola's Jesco United will be welcoming TP Mazembe of the DR Congo to Zambia. In athletics news, an anti-doping seminar which brought together top Kenyan athletes aimed at curbing the use of banned substances and maintain the integrity of the sport is taking place in Eldoret in Kenya. World marathon record holders Eliud Kipchoge and Bridget Kosgei, as well as world 800 meters record holder David Rudisha, are among the cream of top athletes at the conference. Susan Kamau, the CEO of Athletics Kenya, said training of athletes is fundamental in the anti-doping war.
As Athletics Kenya, again, I want to reiterate that we are going to do everything within our powers to fight this doping money.
David Rudisha, 800 meters world record holder, said it is disturbing that Kenya is among countries with growing incidents of doping cases.
This is very alarming, and I'm happy because the Athlete Integrity Unit, AIU, together with ADAC and Athletic Kenya and also the government, they are doing their best to see that we get over these issues of doping.
In rugby news, the Springbok Women's Sevens squad of South Africa will be playing in front of their home fans for the first time when they compete at the Cape Town Sevens on Friday the 13th of December. African champions, the Springboks, are not one of the best 11 teams in the world, but are excited to have received an invite. The players are excited at the opportunity to showcase their talents on the world stage. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend, and we look forward to your report again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The United Nations World Food Programme says it is struggling to raise more than $200 million to ease food insecurity in Zimbabwe. Economic collapse and recurring droughts in the country, once the breadbasket of Southern Africa, have left 5.5 million people without enough food to eat. Rwandan dissident Vitoa Ingabire says President Paul Kagame's government denied her an exit permit to travel to Spain to receive the Spanish Human Rights Award for her fight for justice. However, some people in the country still accuse Ingabire of involvement in disseminating genocide ideology. And Liberian diaspora have gathered here in Washington, D.C. for a 2-day all-Liberian diaspora conference to address issues ranging from economic development to dual citizenship, immigration protection for Liberians abroad, war crimes, and women empowerment. That is it for this Friday, December 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you a very, very good weekend.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, 2019 has been the year of Ghanaians in the diaspora returning to their roots in their West African homeland. The year of return on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
On December 6th, Border Crossings will bring you the greatest songs inspired by the soul genre. You'll hear smash hits from Three Dog Night, Holland Oates, and George Michael. If you like these tracks, you'll love our Soul Inspirations theme. December 6th on The Voice of America.
Thank you.